Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Played a little audio earlier today from Elizabeth Smart, and it's audio that appears in Post-Traumatic Wedding. And so somebody said, hey, I would like to hear more of that. So for those of you who've never heard this, I'll play you some of it. Now, one of the coolest parts about post-traumatic winning is the fact that it comes from culture of the Marine Corps, right? And so I played this audio when I talk about where the name comes from. And I think the winning piece is part of it, because the winning is linked to the fourth path. The fourth path is about winning, right? And the fourth path, once you understand you can win, that makes hope real. It's not an irrational hope. It's a rational hope based on the fact that others have gone down this path, and I can see this path. Okay, so this is where I show this video. Now, you've heard this before, but this is where the name comes from.
We've got a great Marine Corps. We've got a great Marine Corps. We've got great Marines. Our families support us. The nation supports us. We just have to execute. And we are executing every day. And Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. We've got to win.
So you've heard that before. So I know that you didn't. That, like, Mac, really? That's not what I want to hear. I know that, okay, but I'm just going to go through and play for you some of the audio. Now, you probably heard the rabbi, if you're at all familiar. This is the rabbi talking about how you can grow from stress. And this is fundamental. So the premise of post-traumatic winning is you choose how you respond. You can't choose what comes into your life. Most of us don't choose any of the traumatic events that happen to us, but you can choose, without a doubt, you can choose the way you respond. And this is a rabbi by the name of Abraham Twersky. And he's talking about, he uses this example of reading a story about lobsters. And I would liken the lobster and the way the lobster can cope with its own adversity as the same dilemma that people face. And that is, there's two very different roads you can go down. One is the road of endurance. You can suck it up. You can hope to get better. You can medicate yourself. You can numb the systems, and you can go to group therapy. You can go to individual therapy, and you can do that for the rest of your life. That's a path of endurance. If you go down that path, I would wish you, with all sincerity, all the best of luck, because that's where most people go. But I'm going to tell you there's a different path, and the rabbi talks about that path here.
There's something I want to tell you about.
Oops, I keep moving the slide.
There's something I want to tell you about the stress and how we have to look at stress, okay? And I think it's an important thing because many people have told me from my lectures it's the one thing they remember, okay? I was sitting in a dentist's office and looked at an article that said, how do lobsters grow? Well, I don't care how lobsters grow. But I was interested in it. And it points out that a lobster is a soft, mushy animal that lives inside of a rigid shell. That rigid shell does not expand. Well, how can the lobster grow? Well, as the lobster grows, that shell becomes very confining. Right? And the lobster feels itself under pressure and uncomfortable. It goes under a rock formation to protect itself from predatory fish, casts off the shell, and produces a new one. Well, eventually, that shell becomes very uncomfortable as it grows, right? Back under the rocks. Good. And the lobster repeats this numerous times. The stimulus for the lobster to be able to grow is that it feels uncomfortable. Right? Now, if lobsters had doctors, they would never grow. Because as soon as the lobster feels uncomfortable, goes to the doctor, gets a Valium, gets a Percocet, feels fine.
He neglects to say, goes to group therapy, goes to individual therapy, I feel fine.
Never gets off its shell. So I think that we have to realize is that we have to realize that times of stress are also times that are signals for growth. And if we use adversity properly, we can grow through adversity.
Yeah, Josh Goldberg showed me that the first time I ever saw it. And so when you link that to Frankl's We Choose, right, which is the premise, We Choose, he illustrates it by using the lobster. And like I said, I mean, I would, those two very, very different paths. And I will tell you this, though. You can, and I say this, you can't medicate yourself to a great place, but medication may be part of going down that path. So would the post-traumatic winning path include medication? Absolutely it would. Would the post-traumatic winning path include individual therapy and group therapy? Absolutely it would. Oh, so it embraces it. Absolutely it does. It doesn't end there, though, and that's the fundamental difference between the two of them. Okay? This is somebody who you might hear from this week. Okay? Because Matt Kuiker looked at me not too long ago and said, you know, I'd be dead if it wasn't for you. And so he's one of those guys who has thought about killing himself and then found a different path and didn't. So this is Matt Kuiker talking about his life. Now, remind you, he's 22 years old, right? 22 years old. I mean, amazing. So this is him. He's out of the Marine Corps now.
Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Kuiker. I'm here to let y'all know about post-traumatic winning. But beforehand, let me give you a little background on me. My father committed suicide on the phone with me, my mom, and my brother when I was 9 years old. And we lost him. That was the first traumatic thing that's happened in my life. Before then, though, I lost my uncle. He got T-boned outside the road trying to get a crack rock. And then before that, my uncle also killed my aunt in front of everyone. He shot her. After I lost them, in my sixth grade year, I lost one of my good friends, Victor, to suicide. He hung himself and wrote a letter and stated out why he did it. And he wrote out that I was one of his only friends. And he thanked me for being his only friend. I joined the Marine Corps. I've been with this girl for a while, about a little over 2 years. I proposed to her. Next thing you know, I find out my brother committed suicide. He jumped off my balcony at my apartment head first. There's no saving him. And I go home to bury him, and I find out when I go home that him and my fiance were sleeping together for about a year, and I didn't know about it until after he died. And I'm not gonna lie, I was just like you when I walked into this class in January 2019. I didn't want to be here. I thought,
hold on, I was getting the next clip ready.
Hi everyone, I'm Matt Kiker. Since then, and I'll go ahead and Mac, and I didn't want to be here. I thought it was stupid.
That's where we left off.
I didn't want to do it at all, and it wasn't for me. But I met Mac and made a drone for Ness, and they changed my life. I've been living a better life since then. And I'll go ahead and explain where I am at today, because beforehand I was a raging alcoholic. I wasn't able to think. I wasn't able to do anything. I wasn't even able to perform my job well anymore. And I was struggling with it every single day. And I felt like I wasn't able to talk to anyone. I sat and I listened to everything. And they gave me tools to better myself. 10 months sober now. I'm taking care of myself better. And I've helped more people than I can count. And it's the best feeling in the world. And I've never been better. And I've never felt better. I plan on continuing to change people's life, and it's one of the best feelings that you can ever feel in your entire life. So I encourage y'all to take this very seriously and understand this is not a suicide prevention class. This is a class about how you can take that trauma and turn it to joy and turn your life around and help someone out. So for those of you who have things in your life like I do, and I did have, and I'm still working through, I want you to know that there's a better place for you. But the only way for you to do that is to wake up, pay attention to this class, and lock on to what's going on. So, pay attention. Thank you.
Trauma into joy, man. Can you believe that? You hear all the shit that kid's been through, and then he says that. And I always look at Marines and say, now, how do you get a Lance Corporal to say that shit? And I say, you know the truth. They won't say it. The only way they'll say that shit is if it's true. Because they know in the world of the Lance Corporal, you want to talk bullshit, you'll get called out so fast it'll make your head spin. Yeah. Here's another guy who was there that day. Now, he saw it in January of 2019. And he sees it in January 2019, and then this is Parker. He sees me again 8 months later, and this is what Parker has to say.
Hi, everybody. I'm Parker. I'm a sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. A little bit about me. I grew up playing football, nothing really out of the ordinary, just a high school athlete. Joined the Marine Corps right after I turned 18, shipped off to boot camp. Nothing really weird going on in my life growing up, nothing traumatic whatsoever. After I got this class, my father killed himself, and I had to go back home, take care of all that, you know, whole nine yards. And I just want to say that when I was coming to get that class, I was absolutely pissed off that I had to be there. Me and my buddies were talking about how much we didn't want to be there, trying to make up excuses on how to get out of that class because we just didn't want to go. And, you know, I didn't know that sitting through that class was going to change my life. So I've got a message for those of you who think you're going to be able to get through the car wash without getting wet. And it's that it's going to happen to you or it's going to happen to somebody that's close to you, and you need to know how to fix it and how to help when it happens. Because as Max says, nobody gets through a car wash without getting wet. And I was one of those people who thought that my life was just going to be fine. And it turned out that it wasn't. Because of this class, I knew exactly what to do when I was faced with a traumatic event. I'm not saying it was perfect, and I'm not saying it was easy, but I definitely wasn't as lost as I would have been without it. But with all that being said, y'all need to listen up, because even if you don't think this applies to you, it's going to.
So that's to everybody. Like, if you don't think it's going to apply to you, let me dissuade you of that idea. And so So then they hear from Jack Riley, and I won't play that for you because you've heard that. And I use Jack as just an example. This is where this truth comes from. And it is this plain spoken truth of the enlisted Marine Corps, flat black traumatic wisdom. And so you hear his voice with dripping Alabamese, and they know, like, yeah, that's us. That's the way we talk to each other. Now, you've heard this before if you listen to Old Marine Radio, but I'll play it again because it's changed for me. This is the Stockdale Paradox.
I would like to give you a way of thinking that has been enormously helpful to me, that came from the Good to Great research for dealing with great difficulty. And it was what we came to call the Stockdale Paradox. The Stockdale Paradox was taught to us by, when we were doing the Good to Great research, we're trying to make sense of the CEOs. And in doing that, I just by chance happened to get to know Admiral Jim Stockdale, who was the highest ranking military officer in the Hanoi Hilton, shot down in 1967, was there till 1974. They could pull him out at any time and torture him, and they did.
Now, let me just explain who this is. This guy named Jim Collins, and he's speaking at what's called the Drucker Centennial. And it's at the Claremont College, which is a very prominent college here in like out towards Riverside in the Claremont area. So Jim Collins and the whole Good to Great is a book. And written by Jim Collins. So, and the book is centered on how some companies transition from being good to great, but how most fail to make that transition. So it's a best-selling book. It's called Good to Great by this guy named Jim Collins. Let me find out who Jim Collins is, because I should probably know that. Let me see if there's a Wikipedia page devoted to him. Jim Collins, jimcollins.com. I want his bio, though. Articles, commentary, culture, leadership. Concepts. Good to Great on Jim Collins, Wikipedia. All right. An American researcher, author, speaker, and consultant focused on the subject of business management and company sustainability and growth. Receives his Bachelor of Science in Mathematical Sciences at Stanford in 1980. Whoa. He returns to Stanford, gets an MBA from their School of Business in 1983. And then he worked as a product manager for Hewlett-Packard for 18 months before quitting his job to help manage his wife's ascending triathlon career. Collins began his research and teaching career on the faculty at Stanford in their Graduate School of Business in 1988. He receives their Distinguished Teaching Award in 1992. He publishes his first book, Beyond Entrepreneurship, Turning Your Business into an Enduring Great Company, in 1992. He publishes first bestseller, Built to Last, in 1994. He founded a management laboratory in Boulder, Colorado, where he now conducts research and teaches executives at the corporate and social sectors. During that time, Collins has served as a senior executive at CNN International. He's also worked with social sector organizations such as John Hopkins, the Girl Scouts, the Leadership Network of Teachers, the American Association of K-12 Superintendents, and the United States Marine Corps, although that's unfootnoted. Collins is married to former triathlete and 1985 Ironman World Champion winner Joni Ernst. Different Joni. Oh, Joanne Ernst. I'm sorry. Okay, so that's who Jim Collins is. Never served in the military. Stanford guy. Stanford math guy. Blah, 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 blah. All right, so now, and then I'm going to give you the significance of this later.
Tortured over 20 times. And I had the privilege to get to know Admiral Stockdale. And we were going to the faculty club one day, and I had read his book in Love and War, which was written in alternating chapters by himself and his wife about their years when he was in the camp. And I got depressed reading the book because it seemed so bleak. It seemed so difficult. It seemed, you know, it's like we can all endure anything if we know it's going to come to an end and we know when. But what if you don't know if it's ever going to come to an end? And you certainly don't know when. So I asked Admiral Stockdale how he dealt with that. And he said, you have to realize I never got depressed because I never, ever wavered in my faith that not only I would get out, but I would turn being in the camp into the defining event of my life that in retrospect I would not trade. Later, when we were up the hill, I asked him, I said, Admiral Stockdale, who didn't make it out as strong as you? And he said, easy, it was the optimists. I said, the optimists? You sounded optimistic. He said, no, I was not optimistic. I never wavered in my faith that I would prevail in the end, but I was not optimistic. I said, what's the difference? Well, the optimists always thought we'd be out by Christmas. Of course, Christmas would come and it would go. And then we were going to be out by Easter and Thanksgiving, and then Christmas would come again, and they died of a broken heart. And that's when Admiral Stockdale grabbed me by the shoulders and said, this is what I learned. When you're facing, you're imprisoned by great calamity, by great difficulty, by great uncertainty, you have to, on the one hand, never confuse the need for unwavering faith that you will find a way to prevail in the end, with, on the other hand, the discipline to confront the most brutal facts we actually face. And we're not getting out of here by Christmas.
Now, let me tell you how my growth relative to that has changed, and the experience of doing this has changed me. And it's almost like the progressive deepening of your understanding of these issues. When I first saw that, the reason, and the title of the slide is Confronting the Truth. I don't believe that confronting the truth is the most important part of that, what he says, anymore. I believe there's a more important concept in there. And I couldn't have told you this 20 months ago. And the more important concept is the restoration of hope. So the Stockdale paradox is never confuse the need for unwavering faith that you will find a way to prevail in the end. Well, if all I'm staring at is this blackness down this cave, and all that, you know, that I've been offered is endurance, is, you know, we'll medicate you and you can go to group therapy and talk therapy. If that's it, that's a tough slog, man. And there's no hope. That's as good as it gets for me. Well, yeah. You know, hopefully we'll make progress in therapy and maybe you can come off some of the meds. But yeah. So to me, I think I would say 1A and 1B of that quote. 1A is the restoration of hope. That when you walk out of here today with no fucking doubt in your mind, are you going to know that there is a path that you can walk through any trial that will take you to a great place. Without a doubt, you'll know that. And I think that's ahead of confronting the truth. You could confront the truth, but if all that you've been offered is endurance, that's not a good place. The key thing is to know that you can prevail in the end. Dare I say that you will prevail in the end. So, I mean, to me, this has gotten more and more important. And it's this wonderful logical progression from Viktor Frankl through Rabbi Twersky, through Matt Kiker, through, you know, Sergeant Doe, right, through Jack Riley, and then through guys like James Stockdale. So, yeah, the power of it, in my opinion, is overwhelming. There's a video and from the Pacific that I play, and it's I won't do this because you have to. The most powerful part of the video is when he has a panic attack, and you'd have to see it. So it's I use that to kind of illustrate that this is what it looks like when we're faking it. I put up a billboard of an 800 number and say, this is what it looks like when we're faking it. This is where it takes you. And then I play this, something you've heard. Hell, you might have just heard it because I like it as a commercial. But this little piece of audio, this is what faking it sounds like.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
Okay, that's what faking it. That's what faking it sounds like. So the first commandment is don't fake it. With you, the people that are close to you, don't fake it. Elizabeth Smart shows up in there. And then I play this because I talk, especially with groups of Marines and people in the military, I talk about why you keep your honor clean. You know, you're not going to get over any of this stuff. So why do you keep your honor clean? And for those of you that are familiar with this, you'll understand. You keep your honor clean for you. But this is one of the most powerful videos I've ever seen that teaches that. And this is a guy named Barnado Simpson. He's being interviewed in 1970 after the My Lai massacre. And he's trying to explain what happened. Now, he's a stand-up kid. He was in college, dropped out of college so he wouldn't be drafted, joins the Army, winds up in Alpha Company, I think. No, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment. And under the command of Ernest Medina, Lieutenant Callie is a platoon commander in his company. And they perpetuate the My Lai massacre. And so in 1970, he's sitting there in this suit. And he's trying to explain what happened. And then the BBC goes back in 1988, which is 20 years after the event, and they interview him. And then I want to say 9 years after the second interview, he commits suicide because he can't live with it anymore. He can't live with it. So this is Barnado Simpson. I wish he would have seen post-traumatic winning.
Well, there was no certain age not to kill. There was everyone to kill. And it was in My Lai. A week after, we had this orders. Our captain, Medina, was telling us about we was going in and burn down and kill everything that was in the village. And that we would leave nothing standing. That's women, children, babies, cows, cats, anything. And that morning, about 7 o'clock, we boarded the choppers and we went into the village. And when we got off the chopper, we started shooting. And I remember from the first incident, as I was coming up on an area, there was a man got up with a weapon and ran into a hamlet. And this lady got up and she ran and turned and had her back turned to me. And my platoon leader, Lieutenant LaCrosse, told me to shoot her. And I said, no, well, you shoot her, man. I don't want to shoot no lady, you know. So he said, well, I'm getting a direct order to shoot. And if you don't shoot her, that you can be shot yourself. So as she'd been putting her foot in the door, I shot her about 5 or 6 times. And I went there and turned over, and there was a little 3-month-old baby on the arms, which I thought it was a gun, you know. It just kind of cracked me up.
Was the baby dead?
Yes, it was dead.
The bullets had gone through her?
Yes.
Now, this is kind of the pause. And it says 20 years after this,
can you tell me,
he'll kill himself.
What this book is, why you've kept it?
Now, this is Barnado Simpson sitting in his home now in Jackson, Mississippi, and he's sitting there with a scrapbook that he's made of clippings and pictures of me live. And this guy's, you'll tell by the accent, he's a BBC guy.
This is my life. This is my past. This is my present. This is my future. And I keep it, you know, to remind me. But it's always there. This is it. This is my life. This is everything. This is the way I am. This is what made me this way.
Have you ever seen any photographs of the people you killed?
Yes.
Have you got those photographs?
I have photographs of the people I killed. Even if I don't open a book, I see it. In my nightmares. If I never open this book, it's still there. But how can I forget that? I forgive. I can't. I live with it every day. I don't let anyone get close to me. The loving feeling, or the caring feeling, is not there.
Now, I don't believe he didn't come back like that, but I imagine that as he was involved in relationships. I probably imagine that he probably had anger issues. I don't know if he had a drinking problem. You can see him shaking. His face is puffy from the medications. And so in relationship after relationship after relationship that he probably tried to get in, everybody walked away saying, I can't do this. And he finally said, I can't endure the rejection anymore, and says that and makes that statement. He didn't start out like that, I guess is my point.
And that was caused by me lying.
That was caused by me lying. My little boy playing in my grandmother's front yard here in Jackson, at his grandmother's house. And there were some teenagers across the street, got into an argument. It was 14 and 15. And one went home and got a gun. And the other one just ran in the direction where my little boy was playing. And he shot. He shot him in the head. I was in the house. And I came out and picked him up. But he was already dead. He was dying. So when I looked at him, his face looked like the same face of the child that I had killed. And I said, this is the punishment for me killing the people that I killed.
I'll never forget the first time I heard that. I was like, holy shit, I've never seen anything like that. And that the murder of his son was God paying him back for what he had done in Vietnam. It's just horrible.
Are you ashamed or sorry for what you've done?
Yes, I'm ashamed. I'm sorry. I'm guilty. But I did it.
And the point I make to everybody is like, I don't care if you're flying a helicopter in a training. I don't care if you're out on the weekend with your friends. You keep your honor clean for you. You do the right thing for you because you've got to live with the things that you do. And we're all lucky, you know, when we're young and we do two stupid things, when we get in the car. I mean, people my age, I mean, we used to drive after we were drinking all the time. I mean, nobody like left their car at a bar and went back and got it the next day unless you were like stumbling face down drunk. And most of us lived through all that stuff. So there's that whole being young and that whole feeling of invincibility. And you see that and you're just like, that the rules that govern the universe really don't apply to me. Oh, that's not going to happen. Oh, and then it does. So I try to make the point that you keep your honor clean for you. Nobody else. For you. And so because you don't get over it, that's a pretty important concept. That's a pretty important concept. The other, another point that I make is about alcohol. And I'll play this. No, I'll play that too. Yeah. We're going nowhere today. You'll probably hear Grant tomorrow. This is my sister Peggy. This is a Jeremiah Workman, retired Marine Corps Staff Sergeant, Navy Cross recipient, Battle Fallujah. Army Sergeant Ross Pape, personal friend of mine. Ross's two brothers killed, both Marines, killed after they came home from combat deployments here in the United States. And then Ken Rogers, who you know from the program, and who will, in the not-too-distant future, release their second documentary. So, and I think it's called I Married the War. And he and Betty. So you'll hear from those four talking about alcohol. Now, one of the interesting things that, you know, I talked to General Miller about this morning was, you know, just the, you know, the culture of the Marine Corps, born in a tavern, you know, this hard fighting, hard drinking, hard partying organization, and the amount of destruction that alcohol does in to the lives of people in the culture. And it's kind of interesting. He told me that he said, you know, I took a ton of shit for that. You know, but look, if it wasn't true, we wouldn't be talking about it. So here it is.
They're your worst enemy, and I like to party. What it does, drugs and alcohol, is they make your mind weak. They make you vulnerable. They make you lose your reasoning, and they'll destroy you. You want someone to let the monkeys out of the cage, go ahead and drink a half a bottle of tequila and start thinking about your problems. The monkeys will destroy you. It doesn't help anything. It's your worst nightmare.
It all happened kind of at the same time. It was all part of the looking in the mirror and saying, holy shit, I am destroying myself. But not just me. My family is suffering. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of Marines and soldiers that I know that I talk with, it's not until they realize that their family is suffering and most likely on the verge of leaving you, that they're willing to make a change.
Literally, the only thing that really made a difference for me, you know, I was on medications, anxiety, depression, blah, 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 you know, doing this, doing that. Yet quitting drinking was the only thing that really helped. And after I quit drinking, all the other things that the doctors were telling me all this time started to fall in place and started to freaking work, which, as you know, I'm stubborn. It's like, they don't know what they're talking about, whatever, blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, when you're not lying to the doctor about how much you drink in a day or a week, and you can tell them that, yeah, I used to drink 3-4 cases of beer a week. You know, I mean, no big deal. Now I don't drink anything. And now you start actually listening, and you start doing the things they tell you to do. And you actually want to try and make your life better. It's amazing. But yeah, for me, quitting drinking was by far number one, the biggest step to handling my PTSD.
You get to a point, if you do it long enough, you get to a point where you accurately describe what you do. You destroy your life. You destroy the lives of the people who love you. You destroy your friendships because people just get tired of putting up with you. You know, you're an asshole. When you drink and have PTSD, you're an asshole. I was just an ass. I was sarcastic, cynical, pissed people off, hurt their feelings, and didn't care. And until I got married a second time, I was still drinking heavily. But I married a woman who understood that I needed to be able to articulate what had happened to me in Vietnam. And she listened, and I came to the conclusion that she wasn't going to stick around very long if I didn't get my shit together.
So what makes you stop drinking, ultimately?
Well, you know, I just figured out that I was either going up or down, and it was my choice, and I better do it now because I was about past the point of no return. Because I was like drinking a case of beer a day and then maybe a bottle of wine or half a fifth of whiskey or, you know, I mean, I was consuming large amounts of alcohol.
Yeah, so you don't got to take my word for it. they're experts right there that you're listening to. So, but again, it's amazing how much pushback you get back. And if you'll simply just say, hey, look, this is the truth. I'm going to share it with you. I don't tend to get a whole lot of pushback because I think, you know, everybody's sitting there and they know it's true. You know, the question about will you embrace it That's another question. But I do believe, my experience is that once you plant the seed of the truth in them and they know the truth and they've heard somebody who they respect say it, they'll come to it. They'll come to it. This is an interesting video. Again, something see Josh Goldberg planted, not about this guy, but another guy who's in the video. But I found this guy's, what he says, more compelling. And this is data about what it is to have a serious mental illness and the way India treats depression, which is through much more, many more community-based programs. And then this is a study going on in Texas. And I think this is very, very interesting relative to the problems that most people have.
That's absolutely right. So our screening is really universal screening. If you, what traditionally happens in primary care is people wait and the patient either complains or starts crying or is suicidal is when they screen. That is not called screening because then it's too late. So what this is, we are primary care practices are universally screening. Every patient coming into the clinic gets screened for depression, and that is how you identify whether they need to have further monitoring or not. And that is the 12 to 15% of patients. Once they get screened positive, then they get routine measurement at every treatment occasion to monitor their outcomes. And if the patients have significant need for psychiatry, they are referred, and that has been really less than 1% of the population.
And so there's a longer version of that. I have to find it here. Give me 1 second. And that I want to play because I think it's significant. And his name is Trivedi, doctor type. So give me 1 second, and I'll play you a little bit longer version of that. But again, think about that. That's everybody screened for depression. And after general practitioners talk to him, and what do they talk to him about? Diet, sleep, exercise, disclosure, talking about it, and alcohol consumption. Well, I mean, what the hell? We can all do that for our friends, and we spend a whole lot more time with them than you know, 15 minutes every 6 months or every year. No doubt about that. So every one of us can talk about those things with people we care about. And the interesting, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, we know the people that we care about better than your general practitioner knows you because you always lie to your general practitioner. I mean, rarely do patients tell the truth. I mean, you just heard Ross Pape talk about during the alcohol. When you finally stop lying to your doctor about, right, about when you finally stop lying about how much alcohol you consume, you know, it's right. I mean, it would be funny were it not so sad. So here's the here's a longer version of that same video cut. Give me a second. Doesn't always work like it's supposed to, so. But it will, trust me. All right. Here's Dr. Trivedi right now.
So one thing, right, at the end of this exercise today and maybe in the next 2-3 years, I want all of you to be actually as informed as Julie is about all this work. She is absolutely right.
Julie is, she's interesting. She's the moderator of this, and she deals with bipolar. Bipolar mental health condition. Okay. And at the start, she's very frank about it, you know, about the last time she was hospitalized with it. So it's very interesting stuff. So anyway, he goes on.
So our screening is really universal screening. If you, what traditionally happens in primary care is people wait and the patient either complains or starts crying or is suicidal is when they screen. That is not called screening because then it's too late. So what this is, we are primary care practices are universally screening. Every patient coming into the clinic gets screened for depression, and that is how you identify whether they need to have further monitoring or not. And that is the 12 to 15% of patients. Once they get screened positive, then they get routine measurement at every treatment occasion to monitor their outcomes. And if the patients have significant need for psychiatry, they are referred, and that has been really less than 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. Because they're like hypertension, nobody actually, or headache, imagine if for headache everybody wanted to go to see a neurosurgeon, you couldn't find any. That is what we do with depression. Instead, what we are doing, changing the paradigm so that most patients who can be treated in primary care get treated there, and then those who need to go to psychiatry or psychotherapy, then they go there. And we've also created teletherapy modules and other things to envelop all this. But as a result, we are actually leaving patients in the right place and getting the right treatment without having to run around to find a psychiatrist.
So what could be more the right place than the people that know you and love you and care about you to talk about these things with you? I'm not sure if you can find a brighter place than that to do it. To talk to somebody who doesn't know you, who has a financial relationship with you and a health relationship with you. You could make the argument that that person might not be the right person. The next little piece of video that I show is Will Smith. And this is, so we're going to talk about self-discipline. So who would Marines use to talk about self-discipline? And so it's this little piece of video.
99% of people are not willing to do what it takes to make their dreams come true. The Marines have a saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. The center of bringing any dream into fruition is self-discipline. You know, something as simple as food and eating, it's not about your body as much as it is about your mind. It's getting command of your mind to be able to choose actions that are in your own best interest. Every day, we are choosing shit that's not in our own best interest. So if the world is attacking you and the world wants to fight you and the world's trying to hold you down, so you're going to kick yourself in the balls? So you're going to stop yourself from getting what you dream? And I think the word discipline has kind of gotten a bad name. We think about it in terms of punishment. I'm not talking about discipline in that way. I'm talking about discipline in the sense that you forego immediate pleasure for the exchange of long-term self-respect. I believe that self-discipline is the definition of self-love. That when you say that you love yourself, that means that you have behavior towards yourself that is loving. Self-discipline is the center of all material success. You cannot win the war against the world if you can't win the war against your own mind.
So, you know, you talk about these things that you have to be, you have to do. And, you know, and they're like, oh, whatever. And then you, like, roll Will Smith on them. Like, hey, pretty cool dude, pretty successful dude. He's telling you straight. It's about hard work. It's about self-discipline. And it's a choice that you make 100%. So it gets deeper. Then after that, they hear this, right? This is about being a leader in all of this.
If you don't love your Marine, then you really ought to get out. The only reason I stuck around that low-paying outfit for 40 years for the absolute pleasure of serving alongside cocky, rambunctious, disciplined, selfless, unbelievably selfless young Marine. And the infantry got its name, infantry, young soldier. And I enjoyed being around them. And in the military, it's all about the team. And so if you don't know the team players beyond simply their rank and last name, you don't care about them deeply. I mean, just go up to Bethesda anytime you want to see the cost of war and see the ranks on the room. if you're walking into Lance Corporal here, Lance Corporal there, PFC here, Sergeant there, Lieutenant, if you don't care about these guys, don't expect them to care about what's important to you. They're putting their lives on the line.
So, you know, one of the things I talk about is that of all the things that guy could say, of all the things that he could say, what does he say? He says, love them. Really? Like, so of all the leadership advice, you know, he can give you, the piece of advice that he does give is love them. What? So, and then that gets followed up by with this. And this is General Furness talking about, and this screws him up even more. because it's like, okay, love them. And now General Furness says, you got to know them better.
This is Major General Furness again. One of the critical parts to making post-traumatic winning work is getting to know your Marines better. That starts with utilizing the Octagon or our own counseling order. But the bottom line is you've got to get to know who you're leading. You got to get to know your Marines and sailors better and try to get them on a path to make them better human beings first. Better human beings make better Marines and sailors. Better Marines and sailors make better warfighters. And then we've also doubled down on how we counsel Marines in the division, not just using performance counseling, but counseling to get to know who they are first and foremost, get them on a path to be better people, better individuals, so that they can become better Marines. And so we're implementing that step by step. It's taken hold throughout most of the units in the division, and it has shown great promise.
So these two guys that have been in the military for so long are talking about love them, know them better. And then the next question is, how do you do that? And then the last, the next piece of audio that I play is from Libby. And Libby talks about, I talked about, this is how I learned this. I didn't learn this from Viktor Frankl. I learned this from doing this. And so I play this audio and I tell everybody, listen to her voice after the beep. Because Libby's great fear was her son was going to kill himself.
Hi, everyone. My name's Libby and I'm Luke's mom. Luke deployed in Iraq in 07-08, came home and went through about 10 years of dealing with PTSD. Several things happened. Of course, you did the usual of going to therapy, seeing counselors, trying drugs, abusing alcohol, having a hard time of it. And as a parent, didn't really know what to do to help him. I just want to tell you what happened, though, one day. He came home visiting me and in the kitchen. I could tell there was a little bit of a difference in Luke. And he said he'd been listening to a podcast by a Marine named Mac. And it was kind of he had kind of an epiphany. He just said he heard some things, some truths that had made a big difference in how he was dealing with things. And I could just tell by looking at Luke that there was a difference. I could see a lightness in him. Any parent knows how hard it is to watch someone suffer. And they also know what a joy it is and when you feel like that person is better. I don't know if Mac realized that he made a difference, such a big difference in Luke's life, but subsequently in my life, my husband, Luke's brother's life, his girlfriend Emma's life, you know, we could all feel a difference in Luke. Matt talks a lot of times about a dark room, people in trauma are in, and there's a door leading the way out. I guess all I can think of is a lot of people in that room with them. And then the door opens, not just that person walks out, but all the people connected to him walk out with him. So anyway, it's been such a great year now. It's been a year since Luke talked to Mac, and things have changed so much. It's really hard to believe, because I thought, well, what difference? Why is it so different that just hearing it from Mac? But what he heard from Mac are things he hadn't heard from other people on how to deal with what he was going through. And he's also now reached out to other people. that are suffering. And like Max says, by giving to other people, it lightens your load too. You feel empowered almost. Mac and I started exchanging emails after I'd heard Luke's email, and he wrote back and, you know, told me that I didn't need to thank him. But I told him that he did not understand at all that it wasn't just Luke that he helped, it had a tsunami effect. It spread throughout our family. People that love Luke, people that know Luke can tell a difference. Well, and that's hard for me to put it into words, Mac, but that's what it was. When I wrote you that email, when I just told you from a grateful mom, it was just such a feeling that, like you said, I know, you know, you helped Luke, but what it did for me to lay my head down at night and not say the prayer of, please help Luke find joy. You know, I now lay down and I say a prayer, thank you, thank you.
So, you know, what's interesting about, you know, we started talking about hope and the Stockdale paradox, and one of the big things that post-traumatic winning does is I won't say it restores hope. A lot of times people have never had it to begin with. They believed that was the path. And then all of a sudden you see this place that you didn't even know about. I didn't know it was there. And so when you hear that audio from Libby and you hear the way her voice changed, I mean, it's just, again, you can lecture people or you can show them. And the beautiful thing about this presentation is that it shows them and you hear these people talk. And then this is the last video that I play. And this is John McCain talking about his time in the Hanoi Hilton. And let me make sure that there's not another version of this, because I've been working on these things, trying to improve the audio quality in these, and I don't believe that I've messed with. Oh, yes, here it is. Hush my mouth. So here's John McCain talking about his last couple years in the Hanoi Hilton.
The Vietnamese divided us up into different camps in groups of when we had been shot down, because the releases were, first group released with the earliest shot down, Alvarez and company, and second group, third group. I think there were like five groups over a period of about 3 months. And Vietnamese came and gave us shoes. They gave us pants and a shirt. And food, obviously, was really dramatically good. First time we had stuff to read. And one day they took us outside of the camp, and we got onto buses, and the buses went to the airport in Hanoi, and we got off the buses, and there was a table with Vietnamese and Americans. They called out your name, and you went forward. American greeted you, and you walked and got on the airplane. We went and spent about 3 days in the Philippines, where we got, you know, initial physical exams and that kind of thing, and then flew back to the places that we had been stationed when we had shot down. In my case, it was Jacksonville, Florida. And it took me about 45 minutes to adjust. I've never had a nightmare. I've never had a flashback. I've never had any difficulties at all. Some physical difficulties, obviously, but it didn't take me any time at all to adjust. The last couple of years, we were together in groups, and we did a lot of things, from history classes and mathematics to putting on plays and skits and movies and playing cards. And so, you know, it wasn't as if I had just walked out of 3 years of solitary confinement into the outside world. So it didn't take most of us long at all.
So he's talking about the last 2 years at the Hanoi Hilton. And I talk about, you know, what happened when those guys got back together, broken by torture, feeling like they had betrayed each other, feeling like they had betrayed their country. And for 2 years, they mentored each other. And in that process, they transformed each other. They transformed themselves. And when they came home, I don't believe that he never had a nightmare. I think that's a little John McCain bravado there. Because I don't know how you erase that stuff from your memory. And maybe you didn't. Maybe you didn't. I would find that difficult to believe that stuff wouldn't occasionally seep out of your brain while you were sleeping. So that's the last piece of audio visual video that I play. And then I talk about there's two paths, very, very different. And I know most of you didn't know that this path existed because I didn't know it was there until I walked it and experienced it. But since then, I've learned that it is there, that other people have walked it, and that we can not only walk it ourselves, but the thing that we have to do is we have to take other people there. We have to show them the trail. We have to help them walk down it. And it's in that guiding that will transform your life. And so anyway, so by request, there's some audio from Post-Traumatic Winning. So if most of you, it's stuff that if you listen to the program in some way, shape, or form, you've heard. But anyway, Grant Newsham bagged out, so you got a little taste of the audio that's involved in the program. So it's going to get bigger too, which is really exciting. That'll do it here on a Tuesday that feels like a Monday. So have a great day. If you're tuning into Hour 1, a lot of stuff in the news over the weekend. Allegations that President Trump doesn't appreciate those who serve all over the place. So that's an interesting conversation. And so we talk about that a little bit. And so I think Grant Newsham will join us tomorrow. Short week. So the Mensa brothers will be on Thursday, and which is National Suicide Awareness Day. So you'll probably hear a number of things on Thursday. And so have a great day on a Tuesday. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. I think you just had all the motivation you need to. And now it's all about living a great life. It's all about living the high life. And that's what we owe to the people that didn't come back. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, out.